Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J this morning is former state legislator Jeannie Ives, now the host of The Real Story, Sunday evenings, 7 to 9 p.m. on these airwaves. I hope everyone had a blessed transvisibility day yesterday. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. This was an important day on the state's spirituality calendar. And since we are a secular people now, we are a spiritual people, but heavens no, not a religious people. I just think it's important that we are properly observant in service of our God, the state. And that's what President Biden allowed us to do in his infinite wisdom by declaring yesterday Transgender Day of Visibility, one of merely 145 days on the calendar that are devoted to LGBTQ two-spirit plus awareness. So, Jeannie, how did you spend your Transgender Day of Visibility?
Well, I mean, it didn't take long, Dan, before Christians weighed in on this. And even my son came up with, he said, like, the Trans Day of Visibility, like when Jesus transcended the grave to become visible to his followers.
It's a good take on trans, but, you know, I don't think that is as inclusive and tolerant, and I don't think that's indicative of the kind of allyship that the president is going for, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, most people spent their time watching watching basketball.
Yes.
That's what they did.
True. Yeah.
Truthfully.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I plead guilty to that. But while I was watching Purdue and NC State make it to the Final Four, I was thinking about the trans community. So I feel like I'm on solid footing there. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. I mean, I assume that there won't be much dust kicked up over this, since most Christians in this country are political pacifists to begin with, right?
Well, they are. They absolutely are, which I guess plays both ways, right? A lot of people just ignore it anyway. It's just noise. Doesn't matter to them. So, great. That's good. But, I mean, when do
they identify as they identify as Christian the same way a girl pretending to be a boy identifies as a boy. They're pretending.
Well, that's true. And they don't think twice about it. But the problem is that trans visibility, when is it not visible? They let you know who they are all the time. I mean, you can go to Edison Middle School, and they've got the pansexual flag in the commons area. It's visible all the time. And you're right, Christians don't say anything about it. They don't care.
Well, obviously, we're going to defer to our betters, people that are better, more intelligent, more civilized, more enlightened than we are, like Joe Biden, like Jelly Belly Pritzker, our governor, the governor that we've selected overwhelmingly, very happy with his work. To our transgender community in Illinois and beyond, know that you are valued and respected for who you are. You always have a home here, always. Wow, powerful. Hashtag Trans Day of Visibility. That was Jelly Belly's message yesterday on our nation's Trans Day of Visibility. Very, very powerful, poignant words, that sort of allyship, that sort of standing. Because I'll tell you, it's interesting, the parlance of trans community, the Lavender Bund, the thuggery of it all, right? They beat you to death over respect and inclusion and tolerance. Mm-hmm. They couldn't be more committed to respect and inclusion and tolerance, and of course, more disrespectful to authentic Christians, for example, just one example. But the authentic Christians, we're a turn the other cheek. We're the, you know, the deferential sort. So we would never defy a state order in defense of our stated fundamental core religious beliefs.
Well, I mean,
right?
Well, the other thing is, it's like you have too many Christians just don't feel like they can judge anything about anybody because they can't be judgmental.
No.
They misread everything about Christianity.
Well, right. But are they not making a judgment when they celebrate people that are identifying as something other than their biological sex? People that are getting all gussied up to pretend to be women so that they can read stories to children at libraries and in parks. Yeah. You make the point about the visibility issue too, right? It's just so hard to find representatives of this relatively small group of the population. Although thanks to the good work of people like Biden and Pritzker, that percentage of the population is growing exponentially, particularly for adolescents, Gen Zers. So that's an accomplishment. I mean, visit Philadelphia, like the Philadelphia Chamber of Commerce type, you know, the tourism bureau there. They have an ad with two garish men dressed as women, drag queens, as we call them, transvestites, as we call them properly, that are reading, you know, doing book reading to a bunch of grade school kids in a park. And then it's, you know, in order to form a more perfect hashtag respectful hashtag tolerant union, visit Philadelphia. So you're marketing your city as a place to come from. The city of brotherly love, no doubt. Not ironic at all. The city of brotherly love marketing trans story time hour as the reason to come visit Philadelphia. If only they would get some visibility.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And then what Kathy Hochul in New York lights up various buildings in New York City with the pink and the white and the blue, standing in solidarity with the transgender community, too, on this day. And, I mean, the contrast, obviously, people have seen it all over social media, the contrast from years ago when instead the buildings were marked out with lighted windows in the form of a cross. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it's just it's incredible. Then at the same time, I mean, no, I don't think anything was said about the incursion during Holy Mass of the pro-Palestinian mob at St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York.
Yeah, I saw that. You know, without that's being an activist. That's being ally to the oppressed. That's doing what you can to stop a genocide at the hands of the Jews. I mean, that's the line. And again, the Christian response is to do what? Defer.
Right.
So the Jewish response is to do the same, largely to defer as well. So, you know, what can I do? What can I do? The plaintiff wail. What can I do? I'm just, you know, one person living in a community, trying to get by, raise my family. You know what you can do? You can find a way to express defiance rather than deference.
Yeah.
Defy, do not defer. Your kid's school, in the Little League, in your business, your professional, your social civic circles, at a dinner with friends. You can just express some defiance. So there are people that maybe believe that defiance actually exists, that what they're quietly thinking isn't wrong. But if everyone just defers and defers and defers to barbarians, then you will live in a barbaric society.
But that's what they're doing. I don't know if you're going to play that clip from the California school board meeting where the third graders were invited into a LGBTQ club behind the parents' back.
Invited, recruited.
Yeah, well, they were. They were recruited into it. And in every case, when you hear the parents speaking out again, they're all like, but we're not opposed to the trans community. We're not opposed to these people getting together. We're just mad that you didn't tell us about it.
Well,
send out a newsletter about it. They always have to make that caveat, though. All of them.
Yeah, I get the you know, the vacillation that that statement represents, but that they're still doing more than most.
Yeah, that well, I agree there, but they always have to say we're not opposed to the community. Well, okay.
Chet right. And Lyle, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan. A little bit off topic here, but repeat after me. Boiler up.
I mean, I'm a fan of the Boiler program. I've always been a fan of Purdue basketball. Gene Katie, I went seeing Zach Edey cut his portion of the net that he cut down and give half of it to Gene Katie there. I mean, that was great. I loved it. I'm a Purdue fan.
Yeah, but you were predicting early out there. You were
I was skeptical
a little bit. Come on, Dan.
I was skeptical. Frankly, if Edie didn't dominate the way that he did against Tennessee yesterday, the kind of guard play you got from Purdue, that's why people like me were predicting. I don't know if they got the one bad shooting game and they do a little bit better job of approaching the Edie problem in the middle, and Tennessee wins that game. Thanks for the call, Chet. But look, I had a bad Friday. You know, I was on with Cass on Friday, and I don't know how we got on the topic of March Madness, but anyway, we were talking about sports gambling, and I said, you know, I bet on college basketball legally, and I've been doing very well in the tournament, and I did very well on Saturday and Sunday too, but Friday was a disaster. And, of course, Friday was people call in, what do I think about this game, what do I think about that game. I thought Gonzaga would cover against Purdue. I didn't think they'd win, but I thought they'd cover. So I was wrong there. But I came back and I took Purdue against Tennessee yesterday. So, you know, I can learn. Mm-hmm. Anyway. No, I'm happy for Purdue.
North Carolina State's still in it. I mean, they were the lowest ranked that made the Sweet 16. And
yes, a Cinderella story. Thank you, DJ Burns. Mike in Kokana, Wisconsin.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Thanks for taking my call, and I apologize for not knowing your co-host's name, but good morning to you,
Jeannie,
as well.
Yeah, Jeannie.
Okay, thank you. You know, a political and theological tumult is not a stranger to Western civilization, and I often rely on this line. From it's a movie I always watch during Holy Week, along with Mel Gibson's masterpiece, A Man for All Seasons. The screenplay was written by a guy named Robert Bolt, who also wrote the screenplay for Lawrence of Arabia, and there's one other movie. Maybe it's Beckett. I'm not sure. But so this takes place. In A Man for All Seasons.
Yeah, Thomas More. Thomas
More.
Yeah.
God made the angels to show him splendor, as he made animals for innocence and plants for their simplicity. But man he made to serve him wittily in the tangle of his mind. And that's what we got to do. We got to, you know, we have to live by our wits. Biden is trying to destroy not just, Christian consciousness, but Catholic consciousness. We can't let it happen. We're not going to let it happen. And we have to fall back on our wits to survive this insanity. So
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it. Craig, Mount Greenwood.
Oh, hey, Dan. Thanks for taking my call. And good morning to you, Jeannie.
Good morning. Matt,
appreciate you guys a lot. Anyways, what really stands out regarding this regime and all that. They're very accommodating and respectful and all that. Talking. Well, even the White House, when they hit it all, with decorated up with the colored lights and everything for the one of their big days for the transgender and everything. But they did all kinds of, they've done all kinds of things that kind of like even desecrates the White House and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they had some dude with his breasts out, in public display. Remember that when they had that one day and there's all sorts of lascivious conduct going on the, at the White House at the invitation.
I mean,
it was like a Gore Vidal film. Yeah. Anyway, go ahead.
They wouldn't allow the kids to have crosses on the Easter eggs. You couldn't have any Easter eggs with crosses on them.
Right.
And
correct.
So over and over, anything that's related to Christian or the Bible, they're against, and they are very antagonistic to. but very supportive and promotive of everything that's anti-God and anti-Christian.
Well,
this
right.
Real Latin, demonic, and evil regime. These people are actually, they're operating under the devil as far as I'm concerned. They're real demonic people.
Thanks for the call, Craig. Well, I mean, they're secular humanists. The good Catholic, Joe Biden. The good Catholic.
Well, I mean, but speaking of good Catholics, Dan, I mean, just mid-February, right, St. Patrick's, which we talked about before, they obviously had their services interrupted by these pro-Palestinian mob people. But, I mean, they allowed this trans activist sex worker, Cecilia Gentile, to have a funeral.
Funeral mass.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't think they went as far as the whole, you know, sacrifice. They didn't do that full Eucharistic portion of it. But they, I mean, total desecration. People walked in there apparently bare-butted into St. Patrick's Cathedral. I mean, these, so
fault. Exactly. That's the key. Is you're welcoming that. You're saying, defile me, and I will defile myself with you. That's what you're saying. And so, defy, not defer, if that's not too much to muster. Because these are secular humanists. You say, they're anti-Christian. Yeah, they know they're anti-Christian. They don't present it that way because the devil presents himself as a false good. Evil doesn't market itself as evil. They present as respectful and individual dignity and all the buzzwords that you're certainly accustomed to hearing by now.
Don't be a hater.
So defy, don't defer if you want to make a contribution. If you don't, then that's your choice as well. Just understand that you're a enabler of the disintegration of Western civilization, and I'm nothing short of that. That's how serious it is.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission: to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy this morning, former state legislator Jeannie Ives, now the host of The Real Story, Sundays, 7 to 9 p.m. on these airwaves, AM 560. We're talking about the Trans Day of Visibility supplanting Easter, at least in the minds of the state, and the godless status who genuflect before the state, and the implications. This is what NBC5 platformed for Easter Sunday. Chazzy Grosshandler and his parents. Chazzy Grosshandler is a boy who is identifying as a girl. He is the founder of the Gender Cool Project. Yeah, that's how you mainstream something for the kids. You make it cool. You celebrate it. You affirm. Mm-hmm. Here's why replacing Easter with Trans Visibility Day is so important to Chazzy and his parents. And the interesting thing about this is not one of these wild, obnoxious, scantily clad ne'er-do-wells that you see parading themselves down Broadway in Chicago, for example, when it's time to celebrate themselves, which apparently is every day. This is, you know, what presents as sort of a reasonable, center cut, unremarkable, middle income family in Chicagoland.
It's a day to recognize every year how important and how far transgender people have come. Mm-hmm. And it's just a day to celebrate our voices and who we are.
And yeah. You identify as transgender.
I do.
Wonder what that journey has been like for you, because it is a long, complicated, emotional process, but also lots of happiness and joy for you, I'm sure.
Yeah, basically, ever since I was little, as early as two, I always knew that I was different. And I started by wearing t-shirts on my head like it was hair, because I wanted to have long hair. And now look at me.
I think I did that too. I wore the t-shirt.
I mean, I did it too.
So you have some fierce hair here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you. And I really just, I went with it. And over time, I was just expressing myself more femininely than masculine. Mm-hmm. And it was one morning before fourth grade. I was 9 years old. Mm-hmm. And I started crying to my parents. I said, Mom, Dad, I'm not just a boy who likes girly things. I am a girl, and I want you to know that. Mm-hmm. And they looked at me, and they loved me, and they told me that everything is going to be okay. Mm-hmm. And I think about all of the time.
Mm-hmm. Fourth grader is driving the train. Is that how it works in your family? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Well, that is the problem. I mean, these parents are just as screwed up. I don't know how you let that happen. But I mean, the schools are, you know, supporting that whole thing as well, even behind parents' backs. So,
No question. Mm-hmm. But again, that's sort of a fundamental moment when you decide that 7, 8, 9, 10-year-olds are in charge of your household. To me, that just seems like everything is off the rails and anything goes. But by the way, you know, the caveat here, too, because, you know, I talk plainly about this stuff because that's, I think, what is demanded. There is no antagonism because somebody has gender dysphoria. If you don't believe you have gender dysphoria and you're still on this spectrum and you're ecstatic and you love your life, then good for you. I'm not looking to manage anybody's life for them. We're not looking to treat them any differently under the law. We're not looking to confer special rights because of their identity. And this is where we get tripped up. But there's no hostility, anger, promotion of violence. All that stuff is made up. Yeah, there are, you know, one-off nitwits out there that see something different and they want to instigate, you know, some sort of violence, or they want to preemptorily cause confrontation in a way that where they're initiating. Now, this is to say, how are we ordering society? What are we doing when we contemplate the laws that we're considering, the way that we're educating young people in the government-run school system and a lot of the private schools, too? Mm-hmm. That's this conversation. So if you want to, you know, try to erect straw men, if you're not 100%, if you're not a lobotomized ally where you're just there to nod your head to whatever a fourth grader says, then, you know, go peddle your straw men somewhere else, because you're not going to get any quarter here.
Well,
you're going to get anybody backing down here. And this is what I mean when I say, as I did before the Mike Scott's news, it's very simple. Defy, do not defer. That's something everybody can do, and do so in a reasonable way.
But Dan, if genderqueer in the public library will save one person, then we need to have genderqueer in the high school library.
Right. Yeah, they're all in the business of saving lives.
Yes.
Yeah, no,
that's
I got
right.
it.
Mm-hmm.
Jonathan Haidt, center left. He has had a bit of a move to the right perception-wise over the last several years. You've probably seen him. He's written a couple of books now. He's an NYU psychology professor. He writes at probably Free Press, Barry Weiss's outlet. But anyway, he sat down for an interview with Margaret Hoover on Firing Line, who's that's a terrible show, and she's a terrible interviewer, and it's a disgrace to Bill Buckley's Firing Line. But I digress. The importance here is not Margaret Hoover. She's just prompting Jonathan Haidt to talk, and that's who we care about. So here's Jonathan Haidt explaining this social contagion that has been much discussed, although the secular humanists that control all our cultural institutions, as well as the most of our governmental ones, have done a pretty good job trying to suppress this discussion. NYU psych professor Jonathan Haidt on trans as a social contagion, particularly with respect to girls. Because it turns out, shocking, breaking news, boys and girls are different.
So so there's very important older research by Nicholas Christakis and James Fowler, where they looked at that gigantic health data sets, the Framingham Heart Study, and they were able to see that, you know, if one person takes up smoking, their friends are more likely to take up smoking. But actually, so are their friends' friends, and even friends' friends' friends. So the things we do spread out through social network. We affect each other. Now, it turns out, when you're looking at emotions, girls and women, when this study women, when a woman is depressed, that spreads out to her network, whereas when a man is depressed, it doesn't. Women talk about their feelings. They're more connected in that way. Girls, you're connecting on social media, where it just turns out in many communities, the more anxious and depressed you are, the more you get support. The more extreme your symptoms, the more you get likes and followers. You know, of course, it's good to destigmatize social mental illness. We don't want people to be ashamed. But boy, is it a terrible idea to valorize it, to tell young people, you know what? The more you have this, the more popular you'll be, the more support you'll get. And so you get this explosion, not just of anxiety. Anxiety is in part, I think, spread sociogenically, it's called, from social causes, not from internal causes. But we get it for dissociative identity disorder, and it seems to be the case for gender dysphoria as well.
And you think that the data demonstrates that it is above and beyond just the phenomenon of coming out and increased awareness? Mm-hmm.
Yes, because it happens in clusters of girls. It happens in clusters of girls who had no previous gender dysphoria when they were young. Mm-hmm. So it's very different from the kinds of gender dysphoria cases that we've known about for decades. I mean, it is a real thing. But what happened, especially when girls got YouTube and Instagram early, but then especially TikTok, girls just, you know, girls get sucked into these vortices and they take on each other's purported mental illnesses.
But, you know, just shout this guy down as another crank, MAGA, cultist, right-wing, conservative, hater, bigot, transphobe, blah, 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 because that's the quality of the discussion on this issue. And the reason it's the quality of discussion on this issue, to belabor the point, is because we defer rather than defying the mob.
Oh, well, Dan, I mean, this news, this is not news, okay? Women and girls are more emotional, talk more with each other, let their feelings out amongst each other more. I think the first part of his conversation was just like, okay, we knew that like 50 years ago in psychology, that women are different this way. But, I mean, yeah, this is a social contagion. And then also he wrote this, he had this interview with the New York Times, and they talked about his book, The Anxious Generation. And, you know, mm-hmm. he said that there's been a huge increase in mental health disorders since 2010. He takes it right back to social media and the advent of these phones, and that people are just sitting on there expressing themselves and getting, you know, likes for it and, you know, emojis that say that we care about you. And it's just, it's also bad. It's so bad.
That's why his recommendation is no phone until 14, no social media account until 16. That's Haidt's recommendation. Mary Kay, Western Springs.
Hey, good morning. I have a couple things here. Parents these days, it seems to me, don't want a parent. They just want to be their kids' friends. They do defer to the children from anything from what do you want for dinner to what sport do you want to play. They give in to kids, and that's really wrong. You know, here's a newsflash for the mothers of teenage girls who are kind of screwed up. Kids hate their parents. They say it all the time. And these parents take it personally. Like, oh my God, you hate me? It's like, I don't care if you hate me. You know? You're having macaroni and cheese and you're a girl. I mean, you are a girl. Let's go get some counseling if you say you want to be a boy. It's interesting, too. I know a family whose daughter, very liberal people, so liberal until their daughter thought she was a boy. are said to them. Then they got, thank God they went to a counselor. I don't know how that turned out. But it doesn't matter. That's the problem. Parents don't want to be parents. They want to be friends with their kids. Jeannie, I'm working really hard. Oh, shoot.
No, go ahead. Go ahead, Mary Kay.
Okay. I'm working on that petition. And interesting, the people who don't want to sign, when I ask them, may I ask why, they say they give me no reason whatsoever. No reason. One lady said to me, I'm a teacher. That's all she said, and she walked away.
I don't want to what? A teacher?
She said, well, she did not want to sign the Parents Matter Coalition petition, and her only reason was, I'm a teacher.
Oh, I'm a teacher. She's a teacher.
School teacher.
Well, sure, right. Oh, and I, she doesn't, if somebody finds out she signed it, then she'll be accosted in the teacher's lounge. Thanks for the call, Mary Kay. By the way, you may want to help Amy, since you were interested in grabbing on to that bet that Clayton Harris was going to be the state's attorney, when you guys thought the fix is in, as pretending that this was a fight between a good guy and a bad guy as opposed to two bad guys. So over the weekend, it was declared that Burke won the Cook County State's Attorney's race and Harris conceded the race, which we'll talk about a little bit later because the concession is interesting. But for all of you that, you know, rush for your fact-free conspiracy because it's easier than having to engage, and it's easier than following the evidence as it's presented. And you wanted to, when I offered, I think, $10,000, and we bet $100,
yes.
And then people started coming back, and all of Amy's keyboard warriors with their, Amy, you should have taken Dan's original bet. So I offered it again. And I said I'd book it, and then she, I can't afford to, I don't know if I want to. Big talking until the moment of truth, and then Mary Kay called in. She wanted a piece of that action, but she was afraid. Okay.
Yeah.
Jordan in Antioch.
Good morning. So, unfortunately, no, this is my opinion, but with the trans movement, these are the most vulnerable people, whether because of their age and their development, dealing with hormones and psychological issues and puberty, and or they're later in life where they have even deeper psychological issues, and they're taken advantage of by just purely just evil people. And it's no coincidence. This started with the rainbow. They corrupted and perverted the rainbow, and now they want to corrupt and pervert Easter.
They're great marketers, aren't they?
Yeah.
They're great marketers.
Yeah, well, these people are gods unto themselves, the ones that are propagating this and taking advantage of these people. And they're trying to eliminate God from everything so that you can create yourself. Or there are people, the trans movement, and I have no basis for this. This is my opinion, that they're homosexuals who know that they can't admit to being a homosexual. They feel the guilt of that, but they can't turn anywhere because they don't have a church to go to or parents that have raised them to be able to go to that kind of counseling. And so rather than say that they're homosexual, they say that they're a man in a woman's body and they want to have sex with a woman, or they're a man in a woman's body and want to have sex. They're deceived, yeah. And they're psychologically. But that's the greater issue. As you look back to it, they've corrupted it so that they can be gods unto themselves. And the people that are doing this are just evil. And if you have children that are vulnerable, please keep your children away from these people that would propagate that, because they are going to come after them. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Jordan. Kevin, Austin, Texas.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Jeannie. You're dealing with they don't use logic. You know, they have to get a black female appointed to the Supreme Court, but that black female or woman can't even define what a woman is. So how do you know that? So it's just the logic isn't there in the left.
Well, it's more than that. When Ketanji Brown Jackson says that, you have this Supreme Court justice
she's
being
lying.
Nominated. Well, number one. But number two, she's sending a signal, and she's being an ally, and she's right. Affirming. She's
sure.
Saying, yes, anything goes. And when you have that, what did you just hear from Height? If you valorize this, it is you're really doing damage. And that's what Ketanji Brown Jackson was doing. She was valorizing it at a national level.
Right. So my point is, they don't use logic, but what they do use is pure political power, and they are fantastic marketers. And that's something that people have to do, that I've been talking about all the time, and that you've been, supporting. How do you get involved? You get involved in the precinct level. Most people don't know how the politics works. There's a lady in Texas who has the most successful Republican organization. It's in Northwest Texas. And somebody was like, how can you be so successful? What qualities or traits do you have? What did you do before you did this? What she did before that was she was a kindergarten school teacher. You just got to get the Republicans together, you know.
Yes,
you know,
that's good. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Kevin. Yeah, it is. It is Republicans. It would be like organizing kindergartners in Illinois. I see the comparison.
Republicans in Illinois won't even get involved in local elections, and local elections are the key to winning back everything. And they just won't get involved. It's the problem.
How about a little fun here? I mean, because the sentimental barbarian hates ridicule. A TikTok group for fat queers. I'm not kidding. And this skinny honky dude hacked in to their little forum.
This is a queer fat club.
I'm queer and fat.
Okay, thank you for joining. We're just introducing ourselves at the moment.
Okay.
Do you want to go ahead and introduce yourself, Joe?
Yeah, my name's Joe. I go by he, they, and I identify as 275 pounds.
Okay.
I feel like Jay's kind of making fun of me, though. I know it's kind of a shock. I know, kind of a new thing.
I'm just, you know, monk.
Do what?
I said I apologize.
Oh, no, you're good.
Are you comfortable leaving the group at the moment?
Why?
I'm not understanding why you're joining the group.
This is the queer and fat group now.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I came here for.
Okay. And you said you identify as fat?
Yeah.
Okay. This is just for fat-bodied people.
Yeah, I understand. I identify as a fat-bodied person.
I'm not understanding where you're coming from.
Are you guys comfortable with me here? I mean, I'm pretty chill on my end.
I'm not comfortable, no.
Can we take, like, a vote?
I'm gonna ask you to...
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630. And learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. And in for Amy this morning is Jeannie Ives, the host of The Real Story, Sunday evening, 7 to 9 p.m. on these airwaves. Well, we got a... victor in the Cook County State Attorney's race, at least the new Marxist primary. It was announced on the Holy Weekend, you know, mm-hmm. because Trans Visibility yep. Day was Sunday. It was announced that Clayton Harris lost and that Eileen O'Neill, O'Malley, O'Shea, Madigan, O'Connor, Walsh, Boyle, Kelly, Byrne, Cullerton, Burke is the winner. I just want to make sure I got all the Irish names she used on the ballot. Did I get them all? So Eileen O'Neill, O'Malley, O'Shea, Madigan, O'Connor, Walsh, Boyle, Kelly, Byrne, Cullerton, Burke is more likely than not to be your next Cook County State's attorney. Isn't that exciting? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. I know it seemed exciting. From the same sort of people that were wowed by Paul Vallis, who were, you know, all dug in. Oh, they're going to steal something from Eileen O'Neill, O'Malley, O'Shea, Madigan, O'Connor, Walsh, Boyle, Kelly, Byrne, Cullerton, Burke. oh, they're going to steal something from her, this legitimate candidate, this one chance we have to turn things around in Cook County mm-hmm. with respect to removing repeat violent offenders from the streets, for example, because she is going to, she says, she is going to prosecute people who steal more than $300 worth of merchandise, and Clayton Harris is going to maintain the $1,000 threshold, and that is the seminal issue. So if I'm spiking the football, then you're right, I am. Because you would think people would learn something after the Vallis experience. You would think people would learn something if they've been in the city and the state for 5 minutes, that in so many of these races, there is no good guy. I don't know why you feel the need to identify a bad guy as a good guy, because that bad guy is less bad, ostensibly, than the other bad guy. You think that's productive? It's delusional. And we, as center right or conservative me, identify however you want, we decry the self-delusion of the people who continue to elevate Marxists, new Marxists, into positions of power. And then so many of us turn around and engage in a different form of the very same self-delusion and think they're doing something. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
It goes back to like, well, if we just get rid of Madigan, everything's going to be great in this state, right?
Look how it's turned around since Madigan and Cullerton left, and Burke.
It's arguably worse, okay? And I mean, but yeah. No, that's exactly what we did that. We played that game for how many decades?
So she wins by 0.3 of a point.
Yep.
Less than 1,600 votes. I think it was less than 1,500 votes. I mean, that would trigger an automatic recount if Clayton Harris wanted one. It's interesting. Yeah, 1,556 votes. It's interesting that he immediately conceded the race.
Well, that's what they do, though, Dan. They circle the wagons as Democrats. He was probably promised something. And he was probably also told, don't go down this path. We don't actually want to look at what the votes look like. We don't want an investigation into the voting process or any of that.
Yeah, but is there something else here? Is there a reason why that you're right about them circling the wagons? Is there a reason why he would be so quick to concede there would be pressure on him to concede? My thinking is this. All right, you know, it would have been preferable if you were in there, but let's leave it be. Because with Eileen O'Neill, O'Malley, O'Shea, Madigan, O'Connor, Walsh, Boyle, Kelly, Byrne, Cullerton, Burke as your essentially Cook County State's attorney-elect, I mean, I know Bob Fioretti is running as a Republican, but I think we all understand what the odds are there. And I think Bob does, too, but at least he's presenting a choice. With Burke, we get to distribute the blame. Don't talk to us. Wait, where are you? When the lawlessness continues and when the turnstiles keep turning repeat offenders back onto the streets, hey, talk to the Irish chick who's the Cook County State's attorney. Where are all you that were wringing your hands about Kim Fox? Now wringing your hands about Burke when the situation remains the same as, I'll bet you the dollars to donuts it will, under her as it was under Kim Fox. Now they get to distribute the blame to another tribe, the old machine. The new machine can tolerate the old machine if a representative of the old machine is going to take some of the fire away from the new machine. What do you think?
But she's going to sit there for 4 years in that position, and that's a big position to give up to the left. I mean, they do play the long game here.
Give up
but
to
I
the
think,
left? What do you mean?
Well, the radicals, CTU doesn't like to lose any race, and they
well,
lost
I understand.
This race.
I understand, but think about it strategically. She takes a lot of heat. I mean, how much heat did Kim Fox take off of Lori Lightfoot? I mean, a lot. I mean, Lori Lightfoot was just so obnoxious that she couldn't even appreciate that attention away from her onto Kim Fox was politically beneficial. But they're strategic thinkers too. And again, I mean, I haven't heard anything. Has Burke said something about the increased lawlessness with the sanctuary city designation? Has she said anything about wanting to do anything about that? She repudiated the FOP endorsement.
Yeah, that's big.
So what does that tell you?
Yeah.
Has she said anything about this? What, to somebody, an enterprising reporter, maybe Amy's good friend Marianne Ahern can find her way to Miss Burke to say, what about number 62? Gunman in expressway shooting was on bail for possessing a firearm during Mag Mile looting. This is from 2022. They just keep piling up. Number 62, man on bail for allegedly possessing a firearm during the August 2020 looting and riots, or symbolic takings, on the Mag Mile, shot another man during a road rage confrontation on the Dan Ryan near Chinatown 2 years ago. Uh-huh. He continues to fight the 2020 gun charge as well as a second gun case he picked up last year. Despite having two gun cases pending, a judge released him on electronic monitoring to await trial in the shooting shooting case. He is the 62nd person accused of shooting, killing, or trying to shoot or kill someone in Chicago in 2022 while on felony pretrial release. The crimes involved at least 107 victims, 29 of whom died. Preventable crime. And could somebody tell me what Eileen Burke has said about this? What she plans to do about it? What about number six in 2024? Man shot, robbed acquaintance in the West Loop while on pretrial release for two felonies and on electronic monitoring. The man who pistol whipped, shot, and robbed an acquaintance inside a West Loop apartment was on pretrial release for two felony cases and was wearing electronic monitoring bracelet at the time of the crime. He's the sixth person accused of shooting, killing, or trying to shoot or kill someone in Chicago this year while on pretrial release. I mean, this is the series that CWB has been running since 2020. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, you're talking about 36 murder victims in 20, 33 and 21, 29 and 22, mm-hmm. 23, I mean, 18 and 23. And that's just murder victims. Total victims are in the hundreds. So did I miss the press release? Did I miss the press conference? Did I miss the policy statement? Just with respect to this, with respect to this, I mean, again, here, just for emphasis, because I know we're all desensitized. Well, accused of shooting, killing, or trying to shoot or kill someone while on felony pretrial release. There's nobody suggesting anything different. As Eileen Burke suggested how the no cash bail Pritzker purge law should be reformed. No, because I assume she doesn't believe it should.
Has she weighed in on Jaden Perkins' death from that parolee that got let out of jail and then came right back and killed Jaden Perkins, the 11-year-old? Has she weighed in on that? I mean, but I'll tell you what, the state legislators down there, they're just getting a little bit more radical. Of course, the leftist favorite, Kelly Cassidy, she wants discretionary sentences to add 15, 20, or 25 years to somebody who commits a crime with a firearm. She wants those to go away if the terms for natural life. You know, Stava Murray's got a similar bill saying, look, you should be able to get out after the age of 55, no matter what you did. You should be able to get paroled as long as you serve 25 years. So, I mean, these guys are, I don't know, is Eileen Burke and I actually go down there and rein in all the Chicago legislators who actually run things down there?
Forget that. That's obviously not. What's she even going to do in her office? Nobody cares. Nobody knows. Nobody cares. Clayton Harris was boss Tony's pick, and that's all I need to know. No, it's not. And Tony isn't much of a boss, as I've tried to explain to people many times on this show. Proven yet again. That Tony boss. She's whatever she wants. That's just how it goes. Is that the same Tony that got beat 3-1 in the runoff in 2019 by Lori Lightfoot? She just rules the roost. Really? Doesn't seem like it. She's a tool, not a boss. People don't even understand who the bosses are. People who've been in Chicago for their entire lives. So as I said on Stuart Varney a couple of weeks ago, I mean, the problem in Chicago is not the dead who vote. The problem is those who are dead from the neck up who vote. And that turns out to be a majority of the city.
No doubt.
Mike in Littleton, Colorado.
Yeah, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. You stole my thunder with your last comment. That's the problem, is the people who vote this stuff in. And if I could just make a bad analogy, you know, when those planes got hijacked on September 11th years ago, only three people stood up to do anything that we know about. And the rest sat there and must have bought the line. Well, you know what? They said we'd be fine. Let's just sit still. And, you know, it's a bad metaphor, I guess, or analogy, but that's where we are. So thank you so much.
Mike. Robert, Bloomingdale.
It's the same old, same old. Crime is not going to go down. It's a waste of time. What is wrong with voting for Bob Fioretti? If there's any Republican running, I would vote for somebody who's sensible over some radical leftist. It's just going to be the same old wash and rinse over and over.
No, Robert. You know, we have to vote for who we think is going to win. That's what we do. If I think somebody's going to win, then I want to be on the winning side.
Right.
Even if the winning side is in furtherance of my demise. But hey, but we won. What did you win? I don't know. I have no idea, but we won.
I'd rather vote for Americanism and get somebody.
Yeah, I hear you. Thanks for the call.
Okay,
Robert.
But Dan, on that, I mean, you know, you do talk about the voters and Irish names. Do you recall this? Philip Spiewak in 2010?
Oh, yeah, Spiewak.
Spiewak. Yeah, he ran as Republican for judicial seat in Will County, got his butt spanked. Wasn't even, I think, qualified by judicial standards. And then he changed his name to Shannon O'Malley and ran as a Democrat, and he won.
Exactly. Tribes. That's what it is, tribes. But there's
ridiculous.
Not a lick of difference. All we care about is tribes. We don't care about what that tribe or the representative of that tribe actually did, does, or will do.
Or is qualified.
So congratulations to Eileen O'Neill, O'Malley, O'Shea, Madigan, O'Connor, Walsh, Boyle, Kelly, Byrne, Cullerton, Burke. What a victory. Dan Angini in for Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning. Dan and in for Amy J this morning is former state legislator Jeannie Ives, now the host of The Real Story, 7 to 9 p.m. on these airwaves on Sunday evenings. Tashara Jones is the mayor of St. Louis. St. Louis routinely competes with New Orleans and Memphis for the highest murder per capita title in the country. Recently, there was a black mayor's caucus meeting on crime. I hope BLM Brandon was there. Our BLM Brandon, Brandon Johnson, not Baltimore's BLM Brandon, Brandon Scott. Baltimore also competes for that title with New Orleans and St. Louis and Memphis. Tashara Jones, duly elected mayor of St. Louis, had this to say coming out of this meeting of the Black Mayor's Caucus, which is just black Democrats, just Democrats. It really doesn't matter. They focus so much on skin color, and it doesn't matter because it can be a honky in Denver or it can be a black mayor in Chicago or St. Louis or Baltimore or Memphis, and it's the same deal. It's the same program. What to do about crime? Tashara Jones has an idea.
We have a lot of violence around convenience stores and gas stations. So how can we hold those business owners accountable and also bring down crime? And then some of the things that we're already doing, we're finding that other mayors are doing as well.
Yeah, you're all doing the same thing. I know. And it's going terribly. The convenience store, there appears to be a lot of crime around convenience stores and gas stations. So what are the owners of these businesses doing What are they not doing that they need to be doing? Not us, not the city that's responsible for public safety. What are business owners doing? Sounds very familiar, doesn't it?
Yep. Lori Lightfoot said that, right?
Yeah. And Thaddeus Jones introduced legislation.
Brief.
The Armed Security Protection Act. Banks, pawn shops, grocery stores, and gas stations in Cook County must employ and have on the premises at least one guard during the hours they conduct business with the public. What are you not doing, banks, pawn shops, grocery stores, gas stations in Illinois, well, in Cook County, or convenience stores and gas stations in St. Louis? What are you not doing to keep the peace?
Thaddeus
this is going very
Jones.
Well.
Oh, my gosh. He's such a hack. So bad.
Well, that's why he's in the Illinois General Assembly. That's.
I think he's also under investigation, too. You know, he's one of those folks.
I'm sure. I'm sure it's, you know, some right wing conspiracy that's been cooked up against him. For more on this, I mean, crime and economic impact, because one of the things I was just having this discussion with a friend, you know, who's looking to move from Lincoln Park. Gee, I wonder why. She really likes New Orleans, but New Orleans has the same problems that Chicago does, maybe more acute on at least on a per capita basis. And she said, you know, I like Landry, but, you know, he's trying to do some things. You have to understand Landry, the governor of Louisiana. These big cities cannot be saved at the state level. Kathy Hochul can deploy the National Guard for the New York City subway. You cannot save big cities from the outside. They have to decide they want to do things differently. And if they don't, one just wonders what the short-term horizon portends for Chicago, St. Louis, Baltimore, Memphis, New Orleans. For more on this, please be joined by Jim Urio, host of the Futures Edge podcast, also the proprietor of Brandt's in Palatine. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, I mean, the old saw goes, businesses won't locate in places that are not safe. These big cities, even in the commercial districts, are increasingly not safe, as everybody knows, as everybody has seen. Businesses are leaving, but that's just the natural movement of capital, and so we're told from the politicians. But I mean, to that question, the long-term economic impacts of the lawlessness that has been condoned, where do you see some of these big cities? And I know they're not all similarly situated. Some have more diverse economies than others. But I mean, that has to be a discussion that's going on in C-suites and among market makers.
There's no doubt. But the whole thing, you got to look at it from a 30,000-foot angle. Like, these mayors, they're not doing a bad job. They're not incompetent. They told us exactly what they were going to be. You know, things like squatters' rights, defund the police, decriminalize theft, no cash bail. Even, like, if you go back 4 years when the federal government came out with eviction moratorium, all that is greenlighting, stealing stuff from some that doesn't belong to you, stealing housing from the evil landlord. The whole thing is ridiculous, but they're doing exactly what they said. So then the question becomes, what's the end game? And the only thing I can think of, which I'm relatively reasonably sure of, is that it's about destroying things to get in line for federal handouts in order to – they don't want anything local anymore. They're globalists. They want everything to be the federal government here, and then the federal government signs us up for the globalist thing. So if you crash these cities – and, you know, you mentioned Lori Lightfoot. She literally blamed people for carrying cash. And if you can't see that they favor the criminal over the victim, it's, I mean, they've told us they're doing it, and those people voted for them, presumably. It's Chicago. Who knows?
Yeah, but so when – you have commercial spaces being retrofitted, sort of, to be migrant shelters. When you have BLM Brandon proposing $1.2 billion in bond issuances in debt, essentially, over the next 5 years, I think it was, to build more government housing. I mean, this is an effort to transform the economy, to borrow a phrase from the big guy. And so what does that look like for Chicagoland, for example?
Well, it doesn't look good. So there's two things here that are really interesting to play, because one is a very financial thing. You talked about, you know, real estate, commercial real estate in big cities, which that's going to be the big economic problem, because a lot of banks have loaned money for these and occupancy rates are through the floor. But now all of a sudden, and this is the part, the political part that you just mentioned, filling those spaces with migrants, things like that. They're doing things that they know are politically unpopular, and they don't seem to care. That should be terrifying to everybody, particularly when we just had an election in our state, which ran a, you know, one of the pro-crime candidates against a much less pro-crime candidate, and they almost won. It took 2 weeks. Like, literally, they stand up that there are people who are Kim Fox disciples who believe in all those things I mentioned before, and people are still voting for them. So I don't want to let the people off the hook. But the reality of it is I think they can kill two, they think they can kill two birds with one stone, because they can get federal funding to fill these spaces that are gone and are not coming back, and there will be no occupancy because people don't want to be in the loop anymore.
I understand a reliable power is important to fuel a $22 trillion economy. Do I have that right?
Reliable power. Again.
Reliable power, that's an important component to fuel a $22 trillion economy like America's.
Yeah, I would say
is
that
is it important? Because the Wall Street Journal piece by the editorial board opined on this, actually, talking about the coming electricity crisis. And they argue that power sucked up by AI data centers in combination with the transformation of our energy sector at the government's direction, the push, right, to eliminate fossil fuels, we all know this, is going to produce an electrical grid that may not be as reliable as it needs to be to power that $22 trillion economy.
Yeah, you think? You know, these people are blowing up the energy bridge without building the other one first. I mean, if you look at things like the Inflation Reduction Act, which I giggle every time I say it because it was designed to do the exact opposite. If you look at, and right now the left will look at fossil fuel production in this country and they'll all say, look at, we're pumping more than we ever have. Yes, but that has nothing to do with anything. But everything you see in oil right now reflects policies from 5 to 7 years ago. That's where the exploration comes in. And these wells, they do much better at the beginning of their life than they do at the end. And these wells are beginning to get older, but they're all pumping as well as they can now. So in 5 years, we're going to have the fossil fuel problem. And a lot of that, too, you know, coal powers electricity. They hate to believe that thing, but it's true. And the other technologies are not as reliable. We saw this in the EV market with these electric cars that can't deal with winter. Yes, if you want to live in Florida or Southern California, have at it with your EV. But they don't work as well around here. And people realize that, and that's why sales are down. But the whole notion that we're going to transform on a dime, they don't understand the disruption of it and the economic calamity it causes when you get into a market like this, particularly energy, which is everything, and you disrupt it to this level. There's real hardship that comes from that, and they don't seem to care because every time there's hardship, they can just blame it on the other party, and they win from it. That's what it's really a terrible situation in the energy world.
Well, I mean, but Governor Pritzker, he's doubling down on all of this, you know, big investments to Goshen for that EV battery plant. It just recently, IDNR apparently had a meeting a week ago, and in that meeting they announced that they're going to put electrical vehicle chargers at state parks. And, oh, by the way, if you happen to be able to get your vehicle there to enjoy nature, you get to charge your car to get back home for free. So, I mean, this is all just such a boondoggle, and everybody else who's normal is just paying for this garbage.
Do you know how you know it's a boondoggle, Jeannie? There's no questions at all. Because look at every policy. Initially, before, they'd give, like, tax breaks for buying EVs. But now all the money has to go through the government. Like, if we were sitting and said, okay, we see that this technology, we probably should give it a little bit more of a tax break, and then with that little nudge, see how the free market adopts it. Well, they realized that wasn't going to happen unless they take all the money themselves and funnel it to themselves. And then, by the way, like the whole notion of redistributing wealth, the government's very good at taking all the money. They're just not very good at distributing it to the places that they said they were going to. So whatever the friction is when money goes through the government is making a lot of people rich. And those people probably have a lot of connections to the governments that's dispersing the money, too. But again, I reiterate, if they thought it would work, they'd give it a little nudge from tax policy and let the free market handle it. But the free market won't handle it because the technology is dumb at this point.
Okay, one more quick question. How is that $20 minimum wage going to work out for California?
So it really is going to work out terribly. There's no cogent argument to make for minimum wage. The problem that they always is that there's like five arguments against. But are people going to lose their jobs? Absolutely they are. You know what's going to happen in restaurants is that, you know, prices are going to go through the roof. But restaurants are very adaptive and nimble. What they'll do is they'll pay the people the $20 an hour, outlaw tipping, and then charge 18% surcharge in lieu of tipping. So what happens is the restaurants will end up making more money. The people will just make their $20 an hour, and the tipped employees who used to make $50 an hour at good restaurants are going to just make $20 or $25. So it's never going to help the people they think it's going to, and it always hurts, particularly ones who need job training, minimum wage, kids, people, some of the disenfranchised communities. The minimum wage jobs are training grounds for them, and they're eliminating those, and it's really appalling.
I would say you have to explain that to BLM Brandon Johnson, but it'd probably be more productive. Well, I don't know if it'd be more productive, but it'd be more appropriate to try to explain that to, like, you know, dilettantes on the lakefront and in wealthy, leafy suburbs, you know, the basic
and
Econ 101.
And I'll teach my dog how to deal blackjack after
yeah,
that.
Well, right. Exactly. Yeah, I know. It's tough.
But I will point out,
right,
we have a difference of opinion because I think BLM Brandon, you're saying he's dumb and incompetent. I don't think that's true anymore. I think these people don't care one bit that their policies are toxic. A policy that sounds good, that causes problems, is the cherry for them right now, because then they can blame it on their opponent. So I've shifted to sinister over incompetence.
It's a combination. You need both. You need useful idiots, and then you need the sinister masterminds. And Brandon Johnson is definitely more on the useful idiot side than the sinister mastermind. But I mean, there's there's also some hybrids. They're a little bit of both. The other thing I wanted to get to is crypto. So we had this conversation with our mutual friend Scott the Cow Guy Shelley on Friday of last week. I think Thursday or Friday. Regardless, it was last week. And Scott the Cow Guy, not a buyer of crypto. And I just wanted to get your take on this too. You know, is there a burgeoning consensus that crypto is a thing, and it's a thing with staying power? And when BlackRock sets up the fastest growing ETF in human history around Bitcoin, then you probably should take judicial notice and expect that even if you don't understand sort of the underlying point, and even if this turns out to be more hype than transformation, that you might want to think about including some of this in your portfolio.
So I'm a definite yes on that. And this is, again, I don't give anyone else advice, and I may be wrong on this, but I started getting into crypto, you know, several years ago, and then I accelerated that, what you mentioned, with the BlackRocks and the Vanguards and the Fidelities. Because, again, you know, BlackRock's truly our overlord. If they're getting into crypto, then there should be some staying power in crypto, is my guess. But at the end of the day, and if you look, I don't know if you've watched gold much at all too. Gold has gone through the roof, including last night. Gold rallied about $50 last night in futures. And I think what these two markets, Bitcoin and gold, are telling us, they're basically a no confidence vote in the stewardship of fiat currency. Which, by the way, that seems like a very reasonable position to take when we're bumping up the national debt, $1 trillion every 100 days. So if you have me at no confidence, and that's why I'm in Bitcoin. And again, do I understand every nuance of it? No, I don't. Do I think that people are trying to create a medium of exchange that operates outside fiat currency system? Yeah, I do. And if they're right, I don't want to be on the sidelines. So I definitely have a portion of my dollar hedge portfolio in Bitcoin.
Jim Urio, host of the Futures Edge podcast, also the proprietor of Brandt's Restaurant in Palatine. Jim, thank you as always.
Thank you for having me.
And Jim Urio joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. this morning, former state legislator Jeannie Ives, the host of The Real Story, Sundays, 7 to 9 p.m. on these airwaves. So Fox News reporter Bill Malusian embedded with ICE in Boston. We mentioned this in passing on Friday, but here's a little bit more color on the experience that ICE officers have when they're deployed to a big city like Boston, a big sanctuary city like Boston, that is not interested in providing public safety for its residents, its residents who are there legally, and its otherwise peaceful residents who are there illegally, not interested in either, interested in protecting the system, a system that allows for repeat violent offenders, both foreign and domestic, to roam about freely and pray as they see fit.
All the targets today, every single one of them is an aggravated felony here in the Commonwealth. So these are really the cases that are the worst of the worst here in Massachusetts.
ICE quickly takes down its first target, an illegal alien from Guatemala charged with aggravated child rape.
Carlos, yeah.
Minutes later, ICE arrests a Colombian national charged with the rape of a child above age 14.
I don't have enough officers or resources to tackle every one of these public safety threats. Are we going after the child rapist today, or are we going to go after that two times deported fentanyl dealer? Because we can't get both.
ICE's next arrest, a combative MS-13 gang member from El Salvador, charged with a slew of violent crimes. Officers then arrested this Brazilian man, charged with five counts of aggravated rape of a child.
How are you guys not notified about a child rapist being released?
Unfortunately, in Massachusetts, that's how it is with most of these sanctuary jurisdictions.
A short time later, ICE took down their final target, a Brazilian gang member, also charged with child rape.
Just this morning today, four accused child rapists and one MS-13 gang member. Those are the kind of people you're going after.
That's every day up here in Boston. Those are the public safety threats that we really want to get off the street. It was a great day for the teams. That's five public safety threats that are in the community going to go ahead and victimize anyone else.
Right, but the institutional powers are in the business of providing cover for child rapists. Various countries of origin, too. Country of origin has nothing to do with it.
Well, you know, we're a sanctuary state, too, and we're doing the same thing here.
Oh, yeah. This may be a familiar story to Chicagoans. This is a report from the NBC affiliate in Detroit on the foreign burglary rings in Oakland County, the Detroit metropolitan area. You've heard the same about foreign burglary rings in the Chicagoland area. Of course you have, because what's the difference between the Eva Peron of East Lansing, Gretchen Whitmer, and Jelly Belly? A couple hundred pounds?
The security video we've seen over the past 6 months is chilling enough. Unencumbered and well-equipped thieves knock out glass doors, disable the alarm system, and unconcerned, easily and frankly quite loudly slide a half-ton safe down a flight of stairs before carrying it off in a rental car.
They come in teams with backpacks. Each backpack has a different tool set. Some are the breaching tools, some are the electronics, the jam alarm systems. Very quick, sophisticated actions.
Local, state, and federal officers went to work and put enough pressure on these thieves to head elsewhere. Yet they've cycled back from L.A., New York, Tennessee, and Ohio now, and more efficient than ever. Bouchard says the last group of alleged thieves arrested received training in Chile, and they're roving with dozens of others.
Now we know we have teams from Colombia, and New York intelligence has teams, like criminal gangs from Venezuela now.
They rent hotel rooms, Airbnbs, apartments, carrying multiple disposable IDs in case they get arrested. Bouchard says if you're leaving your home empty and quiet for a while,
if you have an alarm, use it. Try to get your devices hardwired. Try to have redundancy of communication.
Yeah, why don't you hire some security guards, too, or be forced to? Like the mayors of places like St. Louis and Chicago and the legislators want to impose such a mandate on businesses.
It's the victim's fault. It's not the criminal's fault.
Right. And it's not the politician's fault when they send a signal the world over, come take our stuff. Come rape and pillage. We're a welcoming place for the rapists and the pillagers.
Yeah, but again, the problem's the voters. But because democracy's on the ballot and my abortion rights are on the ballot. That's what matters to them.
You'll enjoy this. Mike Johnston is the mayor of Denver. He's a big Sanctuary City proponent. He goes on TV with our mayor, BLM Brandon, and others to talk about being a welcoming city and how they're, helping the migrants to assimilate and how Greg Abbott is a bad man, so on and so forth. But behind closed doors, he has his henchmen, as these politicians do. And here's what his political director was caught on tape saying to migrants at a migrant shelter that stood up by the city of Denver. Here's what he's saying to them. Now, much of this is in Spanish, but you'll get the gist of it. This was reported locally in Denver.
Opportunities are over. That's Andres Carrera, political director for Denver Mayor Mike Johnston.
New York te da más. Chicago te da más. Entonces sugiero que vaya por allá, donde hasta también con una verde de más largo plazo, también hay más oportunidades de trabajo por allá.
Carrera is Denver's so-called newcomer communications liaison. That means that he meets the busloads of new.
Yeah, he meets the busloads, and he say Chicago gives you more, New York gives you more. So I suggest you go there where there is longer-term shelter.
Well, and that may be the case. Look, Senator Villavallum, he recommended, they just had a Senate hearing in Illinois, a Senate hearing saying we're going to give, you know, particular classes of people, generally poor people, $1,000 a month, including illegal immigrants. Including,
yeah,
they had
included.
Like this serious conversation. This is the conversation in Springfield.
Well, of course it's serious because they're going to be here permanently. So we're going to treat them as here legally because they're going to be residents here and whether they're citizens or not. Because remember, as Yvette Clark, the congresswoman from Brooklyn, said, we need the migrants for the census to make sure I maintain my district and political power. New York. This is Denver's political director, mayor of Denver's political. New York gives you more. Chicago gives you more. So I suggest you go there where there's longer-term shelter. There are also more job opportunities there. He continues, we'll give you a bus ticket. We'll fly you. We just want, I mean, it's sort of Martha's Vineyard scaled back. Thank you so much for coming. Now get the hell out. We'll send you to Chicago. We'll send you to New York. We'll make you somebody else's problem. This welcoming sanctuary city, open arms, my new Biden buddy from South America or Central Europe or China, wherever.
And they're the biggest suburbs.
The biggest frickin' scam. And you're right. And the suburbs of these metropolitan areas have completely lost their ability to defend themselves. It's really something to behold. For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined by Stephen Bucci. He served America for 3 decades as Army Special Forces officer and a top Pentagon official, visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation's Allison Center for Foreign Policy Studies. Stephen Bucci, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, it's always my pleasure to be on the show. Important story you got here.
Well, if you think the disintegration of America is important, I'd say it's important. And so the lack of anybody wanting to take big risks in Washington, D.C., you have some breadth and depth of experience inside the Beltway. So, your perspective, Republicans as a caucus, I'm not blaming Speaker Johnson individually, but as a caucus, they don't have the votes to stop everything until and unless something is done to triage the situation at the border, at least until November. And of course, Democrats don't want to upset their future constituents, so they believe. So we just hear more stories about child rapists being arrested in Boston and migrants being encouraged to go from one city to the other as every big city says one thing to the cameras and tries to do something very else behind closed doors.
Yeah, it is so two-faced. You have ICE here who are vilified, even worse than most police organizations for doing their job because, oh, gosh, they're just persecuting these poor illegals who are just here to get a job. And people have a vision of them just coming down and, you know, scooping up workers on the street. And that's not what they're doing. They have to prioritize the arrest of some of the most heinous criminals in any community. And they're not just attacking American citizens. They're attacking other illegals. But the sanctuary cities hamper their ability to do that. And then at the same time saying, well, yeah, we're not going to let the feds come in and police this up. We're not going to cooperate. We're not going to share information. But then they do things like pointed out, they're going to send people to other cities and just try and get them out of their neighborhood. It's just so hypocritical and so wrong, and it has to stop.
And when you see, say, the governor of New York deploy the National Guard to patrol the subways, and then you see these other measures that are now coming into place, like, for example, this electromagnetic weapons system, weapon detection system that Eric Adams wants to deploy in the subway in lieu of actual law enforcement. And I mean that on the state's attorney side of the criminal justice system as well. You know, what's your reaction? I mean, it seems to me that, you know, there's the lawlessness that then begets a technological response rather than a equal justice under the law response. And actually, that may be even more dangerous than the lack of a response.
Well, yeah, because they're going to end up scooping up American citizens who may be legally carrying weapons. Or, you know, people who are just trying to protect themselves. But to be honest with you, the only people who seem to get arrested and stay in jail are the citizens who do try and protect themselves. In New York, they don't need electronic detection devices. They need to allow the police force that they have, one of the biggest in the world, to do their job, to arrest people when they commit crimes. And then the district attorney, needs to keep them in jail, not turn them around with no bail, not say, oh, well, that's not really that important a crime. Just let them go. It's almost like a Kafka novel where the criminals really have all the rights and the citizens have none. So, no, we don't need to spend money on weapons detection devices in the subway. They need to let the NYPD do the job they're trained to do, they know how to do, and for the last few years, they have not been allowed to do.
I wanted to get your take on something else. You know, the continued politicization of the United States military and related institutions. An instructor at Army University of Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, is full-on anti-racism with his students. There's a slide that Libs of TikTok got its hands on. We've come a long way. We have a long way to go. The usual claptrap about race as a social construct and the education system of the elementary, middle, and high school levels do not provide the context nor the development of the language necessary to have appropriate discourse on systemic racism and, you know, the honkies are bad, essentially, and all of the typical nonsense that we become accustomed to on college campuses and more accustomed to, particularly under this administration and thanks to people like Milley and Austin in the armed services.
Yeah, you know, putting something like that into Fort Leavenworth, it's even worse, I think, than putting it into the universities. Now, in the universities, you're doing it to young people. You're twisting their minds when they're developing. That has its own heinous elements to it. But doing it in an environment like the Command and General Staff College and the other schools at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, you have a literal captive audience. And when an instructor there starts pushing that stuff that's been proven to be really bad history, really, really bad sociology and psychology. It's junk academia. And to continue to push it there when if those officers push back against it, it ruins their career. So they are stuck there having to be force-fed that kind of nonsense, and it just it breaks down cohesion within the military. It hurts good order and discipline, and it's been proven to be bad.
The key point you just said is that these are officers. These are upwardly mobile. They're upwardly mobile in the Army, right?
Oh yeah, these are a select group of people that have been chosen out of the complete part of their age cohort to go to this course in residence. They get sent to Fort Leavenworth for a year to learn how to be senior officers at the next level. And instead, they're wasting their time giving them critical race theory. It's an absurd waste of time, money, and it's destructive to our military structure.
So there's, they're pushing back, at least the Army University spokesman, saying that the instructor in question acted without official approval, and the person went rogue. But, I mean, there's a lot of questions. I'm on this chain with a lot of folks who are part of that MacArthur Society. I've been on Zoom calls with them now for months trying to figure out what we're going to do about DEI and the lack of enforcement of the Honor Code at West Point. So there's a lot of things to do. People are talking about a Borman 2.0 commission between all service academies and getting to the root cause of all these problems. And there's a lot of consternation seeing this stuff come up time and time again. But again, these are officers, and everybody sits there on their hands and doesn't speak up because they all just want that next promotion. And I don't know. I find their lack of courage to speak up in these situations. I mean, I'll tell you what, as a young officer, I was so appalled at some of the instruction I had at officer advanced course. I nearly walked out of the class. It was so appalling. But people don't tend to want to do that anymore.
They know if they do it, they've made a decision to end their own career. And, you know, if the spokesperson says that this person did this, you know, went rogue and they didn't have permission to do it, well, then what did they do to that instructor? Did they fire them? Mm-hmm. Have they been sanctioned? Or are you only going to go after the officers who raise their hand and say, hey, this is a bunch of nonsense. We shouldn't be taught this in this course. Or, you know, if they go to the commandant of the school and complain and they get backhanded.
You guys are both military. So Jeannie is a West Point, her husband's West Point. She's a Army mom too. I won't say more than she
I'm
wants
a Navy
to say.
Mom that. Too.
And a Navy mom. I won't say more than she, whatever you want to say on it. But so as a layman, as an outsider, I understand how it happened on college campuses. How did this happen in the military when you had, you know, particularly your guys' generations going through this? And Gene, you're talking about what you were seeing even when you were going through particular coursework. So how did this go so far off the rails in the armed services?
It's quite simple. We have civilian control of the military. The civilians, you know, pound the desk and demand that we do this. Some in the military push back against it and say it's inappropriate, doesn't fit what we're doing, and is incorrect material to teach. But others do not, because, you know, like it or not, senior officers are political appointees, and, you know, they'll push back a little, but you get a lot of the idea, well, I can't die on every hill, so I have to pick my battles. So these are the ones they let slide by, and they're not doing a service to their fellow officers, particularly the ones that are junior to them, when they allow that to happen. But remember, civilians, in this case, the Biden administration, and before that, the Obama administration, are they're in charge when they're in the office, and they get to say, this is what we're going to do. And you have the option in the military to, you know, you may roll your eyes, but you sit there in the class, or you do what was suggested. You know, you get up, you walk out, you make a formal complaint, knowing that you may take a bunch of heat for doing that.
Stephen Bucci served America for 3 decades as Army Special Forces officer and top Pentagon official, visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation's Allison Center for Foreign Policy Studies now. Stephen Bucci, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And Stephen Bucci joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer
on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy this morning is former state legislator Jeannie Ives, now the host of The Real Story, 7 to 9 p.m. Sundays on these airwaves. Stephanie Diller, the widow of Officer Jonathan Diller, the New York City police officer who was killed in the line of duty during a traffic stop. Of course, Trump went to the funeral last week. And Kathy Hochul, the governor of New York, tried to, and she was asked to leave, although she says she wasn't, but there's video that suggests she was. And the statement was made generally that unless you were specifically invited like Trump, they didn't want politicians, particularly the local ones, including the mayor, to attend the wake or the funeral service. Gee, I wonder why. Well, Stephanie Diller's eulogy helps to explain why.
It's hard to imagine how long I have to wait to see Jonathan again. When the doors to heaven open for me one day, I hope to see Jonathan standing there looking at me just like he did on our wedding day. My husband died a hero, but he also lived as one. Our world will never be the same, but I know I speak for everyone when I say I could not be more proud of him. It's been 2 years and 2 months since Detective Rivera and Detective Mora made the ultimate sacrifice, just like my husband, Jonathan Diller. Dominique Rivera stood in front of all the elected officials present today pleading for change. That change never came. And now my son will grow up without his father. I will grow old without my husband. And his parents have to say goodbye to their child. How many more police officers and how many more families need to make the ultimate sacrifice before we start protecting them? I don't wish this kind of pain on anyone. Jonathan lived his life doing good for people, and it's now time for people to do good for all the officers he represents.
Yeah.
The data, first quarter of 2024. Unarmed black men killed by cops. Nationally. Zero. Police officers killed while on duty. Just the first quarter of 2024. 29. Is that what people think is happening? Cops are not roaming the streets looking for unarmed black men to shoot and kill? It's never been the case. I mean, and again, the statistical work of Harvard professor Roland Fryer and others, the study that we talked about a few weeks ago by the two Stetson University professors. There's just no evidence to support the claims made by the left that serve as the basis for their decarceration, deprosecution strategies.
Well, but Governor Hochul was on with Al Sharpton, and essentially said, look, you know, we're working really hard to bring down crime. We're making progress here, and we're doing good things. And there's nothing to see here, essentially.
You should, yeah. I mean, Kathy Hochul takes refuge with Al Sharpton. I mean, it almost doesn't matter what she says after that statement, right? Of course she did. And Al Sharpton is there to serve, you know, to sing for his supper on MSNBC, just like the gaggle on Morning Joe, and provide a platform for the kind of response. So this is Kathy Hochul's response, as Jeannie was characterizing to essentially to what Stephanie Diller had to say.
Brothers, sisters, everyone is just so distraught. And yes, there's a lot of anger. Understandably, there's anger about how these individuals who commit crimes over and over are back out on the streets again. So that's one of the reasons we worked hard with the legislature last year to change the bail laws so the judges have more discretion. And, you know, there's a lot of complicated factors here, but I totally understand the outrage of the family. I do, and we're working hard to keep crime down.
I feel your pain. I work for Clinton. Let's keep it going. Locally, the Cook County State Attorney's race we were talking about, that was won by Eileen O'Neill, O'Malley, O'Shea, Madigan, O'Connor, Walsh, Boyle, Kelly, Byrne, Cullerton, Burke. Here's what she said on election night, just to remind you. We want less crime and safer communities, not by locking everybody up, but by turning people around.
Well,
that's your presumptive incoming Cook County State's attorney. No, of course we're going to turn people around. You know what the Cook County justice system is good at? Character building.
Well, look, those migrants, they just want to come and be baseball players, those Venezuelan migrants. I mean, they did the soft report in Chicago Tribune about the 16-year-old who just finds his solace on the baseball field now that he's here. He's been here for over a year illegally. But, you know, he's just going to be the next Venezuelan professional ball player here.
You know how the Cook County jail is just full of single moms who had to steal diapers for their babies? Chicago woman faces felony charges for allegedly smuggling narcotics into a Cook County jail inside a 9-month-old baby's diaper. That's who you're actually dealing with. These fictional people that are described by Kathy Hochul, by your incoming state's attorney, presumptive incoming state's attorney, Burke, and Brandon Johnson and Lori Lightfoot and Kim Fox and J.B. Pritzker and on and on and on. The fictional people they talk about, the fictional profile. And then there's the reality. But I understand two things. One, I'm not in Chicago anymore, so I'm not allowed to talk about it. And nobody else is either who's not in Chicago. And the reason is because the one thing that Chicagoans can cling to, and Cook County residents and Chicago metropolitan residents, is their self-delusion. Please don't pierce the delusions I use to get through the day and convince myself that I'm a good person. Okay, I won't. I'm happy to spit in the wind. They pay me either way. For more on all of this, we're pleased to be joined by our old colleague Steve Cortez, who writes at stevecortez.substack. He's also the president of the League of American Workers, a populist right pro-laborer advocacy group. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Jeannie. Appreciate you having me.
You're not allowed to talk about Chicago either, so I don't know what we're going to talk about because you're not there anymore. But let's break from orthodoxy and do it anyway for fun.
Okay.
So the combination of the indigenous repeat violent offenders and then those violent offenders that we're importing in Chicago, just as we're seeing in New York and Denver and all sorts of other big cities and not so big cities, and the idea that in particular, with the news over the weekend that there's a victor on the Dem side in the Cook County State's Attorney's race, that represents the possibility of change.
Right. Dan, unfortunately not, and those are for both reasons, national out of Washington, D.C., as well as local there in Chicago and at the Cook County level. By the way, speaking of leaving Chicago, when I heard the weather report before you came on that there's going to be snow this week, I'm glad on that aspect that I live in Tennessee in the American South now. But kidding aside, and much more importantly, the main reason I left and moved my family out of the city of Chicago, where I raised them for 25 years, is crime, is that the supposedly good neighborhoods of Chicago became incredibly dangerous, and that trend only accelerates. And that's why I wrote this new article about radical politicians, particularly Chicago, who are literally trying to smash civil society in the United States. And I think even a lot of Chicagoans don't know the full details of this story, because of course corporate media hates this these facts, because it doesn't fit the narrative that an illegal migrant housed at taxpayer expense in a luxury building in Chicago, the former Standard Club of Chicago, a man named Elvis Hernandez Pernalete, an illegal migrant from Venezuela, who was previously arrested in Chicago. So not only did he commit the illegal act of trespassing into the United States across Biden's open border, then committed an additional crime in Chicago, shoplifting at a TJ Maxx downtown. Instead of being turned over to ICE for immediate deportation, which any sane jurisdiction would do, he was released to go back to his luxury building where he lived, and he then committed a horrific act of violence against a woman in Chicago on the UIC campus. So just over 2 weeks ago, on Saturday, March 16th, 8 p.m. at night, woman got off the L at the UIC stop, and on the UIC campus, she was choked unconscious and sexually assaulted. Now, thankfully, he has been arrested, but the reality, Dan, is this is a 100% preventable crime. If he's not allowed in this country in the first place, it never happens. We got a second chance at him when he was arrested for shoplifting in the city of Chicago. If he was turned over to ICE and deported then, this horrific act of violence never happens. It shows you the priorities, though, of the Chicago authorities and the Washington, D.C. authorities, you know, primarily, of course, President Biden, in terms of prioritizing illegal migrants over the safety and security of the citizens of this country, including this woman who had to endure a horrific, violent trauma because of policy failures.
Well, I've got some good news for you. Alderman Daniel Espada is on the job. And he has scheduled a subject matter hearing for April 11th. He's taking immediate action to discuss a potential push to lower the citywide speed limit from 30 miles an hour to 25 miles an hour.
Yeah, that should solve things. And by the way, speaking of that same kind of you know, lunacy and inattention, you know, just dereliction of duty regarding what city leaders should be talking about and should be focused on here when an act of horrific violence like this unfolds. And this is what I wrote about in the article, because the juxtaposition here, the contrast to me was very startling. In the Chicago City Wire, which is a fantastic platform, they ran a very funny headline about a not funny policy proposal. The headline was Hookers and Chicken Parm, because city leaders are gathering in a couple of weeks at the City Club of Chicago, which was once a pretty prestigious institution that holds policy-based luncheons at Maggiano's, hence the headline, Hookers and Chicken Parm. Great restaurant, but not a very great topic to be talking about. So
that is a good
panel,
restaurant name. Yeah.
The panel, which includes state senator from Chicago, Celia Villanueva, who represents the Little Village area not far from where this UIC tragedy happened, they're going to be discussing decriminalizing prostitution. You know, as if that will do wonders for Chicago. Let's make sex for hire legal to add to all of the problems and chaos of Chicago streets. So instead of addressing, hey, we have dangerous illegal aliens who are hiding in plain sight in the city of Chicago. They are committing documented horrific acts of violence against Chicago residents, against this poor woman who is doing nothing but minding her own business. Instead of trying to address these issues, instead of trying to protect Chicagoans, folks like this state senator and others are focused on, hey, why don't we go even further down a Marxist radical agenda? Let's decriminalize prostitution, because that is really going to help the situation on the ground in Chicago.
Well, the advanced billing, we talked about this last week, and I think that is the best forum at Maggiano's, where it's family style. I think the billing of this was, you know, to make sure we protect people's individual dignity. And again, I mean, when I think of individual dignity, I think of pimps protecting the and the state can be the pimp in this situation, or certainly take a cut of it. You know, they can. I think what the working title we have is
Gimme Dat
Hose. Yeah. Brought to you by Brandon Johnson and JB Prisker. So a couple of pimps here. Maybe they can start dressing up like Don the Magic Wand. I think that would be a good look for Jelly Belly. Anyway, individual dignity. I mean, that's the thing. That's the calling card of the Chicago political ruling class. And you just see it everywhere with drug legalization and the marijuana dispensaries, the prospect of finally showing professional sex workers the respect they deserve, because there's no human trafficking and sex trafficking that goes on either, just like it doesn't happen with international cartels and gangs that do the same thing across our southern border and increasingly apparently across our northern border too. That's a bit porous. Just the whole thing is this is Candide. Chicago's Candide. This is the best of all possible worlds, and I don't want to hear anything different.
Well, the reality, unfortunately, Dan, and I think Chicagoans know this all too well, and suburbanites know this, by the way, who don't want to go into the city anymore for understandable reasons.
Well, they can they don't need to go into the city for the prostitutes because they have those key parties in Naperville.
Well, but putting that aside, Chicago is unfortunately, you know, it's becoming Potterville. I mean, it really is. You know, now listen, it was never Bedford Falls. I mean, it's a big city and it's got big city issues. You know, that's for sure. But it has gotten so bad lately. And you're exactly right. Look, casinos downtown, legalized pot, possibly now legalized prostitution, out of control, violent chaos, including from illegal migrants who don't belong there in the first place, who, again, I want to point out for folks who may not be aware of the Standard Club, too, if they didn't work right down.
Oh, yeah.
The Standard Club, formerly, until the lockdowns, which ruined that club, ruined a lot of businesses and institutions, until that, this was one of the most elite private clubs in Chicago. It was described by the Chicago Sun-Times as a, quote, mecca for Chicago business titans. It had a primarily Jewish membership. A very swanky place. I put a picture in my article so that folks can see what kind of a place this is, which then grew to become, unfortunately, a housing dormitory for illegal migrants. At one point, housing over 1,000 of them. And as of a couple of weeks ago, before he was finally, you know, really arrested, housing Elvis Hernandez Pernalete, the accused rapist who was arrested for this horrific crime at the University of Illinois at Chicago. So think of that, by the way, that these illegal migrants, not only are they dangerous, not only are they unvetted, but they are living in conditions that are far better than many American citizens live in the city of Chicago. That's the reality, and that's what we're paying for. Paying for them to live in conditions that are better than many Chicagoans enjoy. And on top of it, letting them roam free throughout the city, even after getting arrested for a second criminal act in the United States. So, you know, to me, I hope this outrage infuriates Chicagoans, because it should. It should infuriate every American, by the way. And here's why I also wrote this article. You know, I don't live in Chicago anymore. I care deeply about Chicago, of course, because it's always going to be my home, and I have so many family members and friends there. But even more than that, I think, and I try to convince all Americans, they should care about Chicago because I think it is the literal and metaphorical heart of America. And when the heart of America is sick like this, Chicago, it is sure to have grave effects for the rest of the body, for the rest of the country. I really believe that. And I'm trying to warn the rest of America, too, that Chicago is the canary in the coal mine that is warning you of where Biden and his ilk will take the entire country. They will turn the nation into Chicago if we're not aware of what's happening there, and if we don't repel this kind of policy lunacy. Because, again, this isn't just, you know, bad luck. This wasn't just a crime that we couldn't possibly foresee. These were systemic policy failures that led to this act of just horrendous violence in the city of Chicago at 8 p.m. on a Saturday night. And this has to stop, and it can. It can with national elections this November.
Steve Cortez, former senior advisor to President Trump, president of the League of American Workers, a populist right pro-labor advocacy group. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks so much.
And he joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and in for Amy this morning, Jeannie Ives, former state legislator, now the host of The Real Story, Sundays at 7 p.m., 7 to 9 p.m. on these airwaves. So Coleman Hughes is a young man we've had on the show before, and I recently did a podcast, which you can catch over at American Greatness, with him about his new book, The End of Racism. He's was a student at Columbia University when he started to get some attention because of his writings for outlets like Quillette, because of his testimony before congressional committees on reparations. He's a thoughtful, interesting, talented guy, not just intellectually, but he's a he's like a professional level jazz trombonist. I mean, he's an interesting cat. Anyway, he's got a lot of attention, and he's very center. He and John McWhorter, the linguistics professor from Columbia, have a really good relationship. And McWhorter, I think, still characterizes himself as a Democrat, though he's not down with the race hustle. And that's sort of where Coleman Hughes is. In our discussion, he mentioned that he's voted for president twice. He's only 28 years old. And he voted for Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden. He said he would vote for a Republican, probably more like a non-Trump Republican, but he's open-minded on the topic. But anyway, you know, this is not somebody who's coming from a conservative ideological perspective. Unfortunately, I hope he continues to think through these things and gain more depth in his understanding of electoral politics, frankly, because those first two choices he made were bad ones. So anyway, he's on The View. And the only reason I'd ever spend any time talking about The View is if there's an opportunity to provide a bit of a lesson in communications. And Coleman Hughes provides one. When the exchange on his book turns to Sonny Hostin, who is, a lawyer. How do I know this? Because she says it constantly, like that's some sort of credential. But that's important. It's important she does that. And it's visited again in this exchange about his book. So just listen to this exchange between the two. And then let's talk about what Coleman Hughes did and what it tells us about how to best deal with the left when it comes to discussions on issues like race.
As you are a student of Dr. King, I'm not only a student of Dr. King, I know his daughter, Bernice, right? Mm. So I'm going to get to my question.
Go ahead. Go right ahead.
I think the premise is fundamentally flawed. You claim that color blindness was the goal of the civil rights movement, mm-hmm. based upon Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech, content of character versus the color of skin. Bernice, Dr. King's daughter, points out that 4 years after giving that speech, actually, Dr. King also said this. A society that has done something special against the Negro for hundreds of years must now do something special for Negroes. He also said in 1968, it was about less than a week before he was assassinated, this country never stops to realize that they owe a people kept in slavery for 244 years. So rather than class, he did write about that earlier on, right before his death. He made the argument for racial equality and racial reparations. And so your argument for color blindness, I think, is something that the right has co-opted. And so many in the black community, if I'm being honest with you, because I want to be, believe that you are being used as a pawn by the right and that you're a charlatan of sorts.
He's not a Republican.
So how do you...
You've
said that you're a conservative.
No,
you did. You actually said that in a podcast that you did 2 weeks ago.
I said I was a conservative.
Yes, you did. So, but my question to you is, how do you respond to those critics?
Let's give him an answer.
I think it's very important. The quote that you just pointed out about doing something special for the Negro. That's from the book Why We Can't Wait that I just mentioned.
Yes.
A couple paragraphs later, he lays out exactly what that something special was.
Yes.
And it was the Bill of Rights for the Disadvantaged, a broad class-based policy.
But he also says you must include race.
No, he didn't. He says it's...
Yes, he does.
Okay, well, everyone should go read the book Why We Can't Wait. Let's not get sidetracked by that.
Yeah.
I don't think I've been co-opted by anyone. I've only voted twice, both for Democrats. Mm-hmm. Although I'm an independent, I would vote for a Republican, mm-hmm. probably a non-Trump Republican, if they were compelling. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any evidence I've been co-opted by anyone, and I think that that's an ad hominem tactic people use to not address really the important conversations we're having here. And I think it's better, and it would be better for everyone if we stuck to the topics rather than make it about me. With no evidence that I've been co-opted.
I want to give you the opportunity to respond to the criticism.
I appreciate it. There's no evidence that I've been co-opted by anyone. I have an independent podcast. Mm-hmm. I work for CNN as an analyst. Mm-hmm. I write for the Free Press. I'm independent in all of these endeavors, and no one is paying me to say what I'm saying. I'm saying it because I feel it.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Did you pick up what Coleman Hughes did there? I think there's two things you need to pick up from that, and he addressed one of them, and he didn't address the other. But Sonny Hostin is, you know, particularly obnoxious and, you know, has the depth of a cookie tray. So she's a useful stooge in this experiment, particularly for somebody as smart as Coleman is. But one of the things that they do in lieu of discussions on the merits, particularly if their opponent is a minority like Coleman Hughes, which is they falsely suggest that he is a tool of nefarious interests, or apply an inaccurate label, which is what you heard Sonny Hostin do, and Coleman Hughes responding, saying, you know, this is an ad hominem, that you're falsely labeling me, not to mention you're like dissociatively saying there's this criticism out there. This isn't coming from me. I'm just here to relay some of the criticism I hear that just happens to be the exact criticism I just leveled against you. So it's her pretending to be representing some third party when she's not. But the other piece of it that I want people to pick up on is how she credentializes herself to confer intellectual superiority that she actually does not have, as you heard when she misrepresented, you know, that we both read this book, but she misrepresented what King said. And so we both read this book. I also am an MLK scholar because we both read this book. But in addition to that, I'm friends with MLK's daughter, Bernice. So my views are beyond reproach. False credentializing. So now you can't attack me on the merits of what I'm saying because I am superiorly situated in a superior place because I've read it. I've said I'm a scholar. Self-credentialization. And I'm also friends with his daughter. So I know, young man. Right. And so it's decredentialize Coleman Hughes. He's a tool for nefarious forces. He doesn't really, he's being used as a front man for somebody else's beliefs. And meanwhile, I'm an attorney. I'm an MLK scholar. I read your book twice to try to give your argument a chance. I know MLK Jr.'s daughter. I have all these relationships and deeper understandings and degrees and so on and so forth. It's a great way to avoid the substance of the matter if you let the left get away with it. The decredentialize and credentialize.
So what I picked up on in that exchange was him saying, look, I voted for Democrats. So he had to also kind of come to the table and say, well, look, I voted for Democrats. Don't denigrate me from, you know, my voting record. I'm one of you. He kind of wanted to go there. And then specifically, like, but I'd consider voting for a Republican, not a Trump Republican, though. So, what about the 22% black of America that is moving towards Trump? And I don't know. I just felt like he was also playing that card to some degree. Like
I think what he was doing there is saying, this is who I am. Mm-hmm. This is actually who I am. You're trying to apply these labels to me so that people just dismiss what I have to say out of hand. So they don't have to you don't have to deal with the substance of the argument I make in the book about colorblindness and his focus, like Bob Woodson's focus on lifting people out of poverty, regardless of their race, as opposed to playing the race hustle that Sonny Hostin and people like her want to play. So you just say, like, this is actually who I am. So I'm not in anybody's camp. I don't think he was doing that. And I mean, again, I mean, I think Coleman, I'd like to see Coleman, you know, move to a more conservative place and embrace it. But he's not there yet. And I understand that. And I think he's straightforward about it. And the funny thing about, too, is his argument. I mean, it is not exactly a earth-shattering argument. No. It's not even a new argument. The idea that this attempt to sort of mischaracterize King's writings by Sonny Hostin because everybody wants to cover themselves in King, as opposed to just use this as a basis for a discussion, which is what Hughes does. But I mean, the idea that this is we should look at people who are disadvantaged regardless of the non-behavioral characteristic of race, as opposed to focusing on the non-behavioral characteristic of race. I mean, good grief. There have been, obviously you go back to the Shelby Steeles and the Thomas Sowells and the Walter Williams and so many more 60 years ago mm-hmm. who have been saying that, in addition to the oft-cited Martin Luther King. So the sad thing to me is it's a rather pedestrian argument, even though Coleman Hughes is not a pedestrian intellect. And if you go and you heard her say, you said this on a podcast 2 weeks ago, that had to be the podcast that I did with him that she was referencing, which you can get at AmericanGreatness.com, AmGreatness.com. But you get a real deeper distillation because I really probe Coleman Hughes on his argument and his views rather than playing this credential decredential game. But I want people to hear what the left does. And also it should be shown by the RNC to candidates, including presidential ones, frankly, about how to deal with this misdirectional play that is made by these mavens of the left who have these shows to speak to the barbarian hordes around the country like The View.
In your discussion with him on your podcast, which I have not listened to yet, did you get into any of the historical examples of who's really the racist and which party comes from a racist point of view?
You know, I mean, I think there's enough racism to go around when you had, institutional racism in the form of Jim Crow laws. But yeah, I mean, obviously, we know what the balance.
Right.
The Republican Party founded as an abolitionist party, and we understand what the respective tallies were. Between Republicans and Democrats on the 64 Civil Rights Act. I mean, all those examples, it is important. And he would stipulate to that. But I think that the bigger argument, at least to me, is regardless of who did what in the 60s or in the 1960s or the 1860s, that's history we should know, we should understand. Informs our, ability to process where America started and where America is today. But the whole approach of the left is to look backwards. The whole approach of the left is to say America is still 1963 Selma.
Yeah, but they selectively want to look back on history.
Well, I know.
That's the problem here. That's why you have to remind them of their history.
Well, I don't disagree with that, but I think you also have to essentially get people to stipulate to what the present is, because there's so much gaslighting that goes on, and there's so much propagandizing, and people are so clueless. They just repeat these buzzwords and phrases that they're fed, depending on the outlets they listen to, but not depending on most of the schools in which they matriculate. That's the problem. Systemic racism, that oppressor oppress that. They just they just drill everything down to these simple binaries that are completely at odds with most people's lived experience, the reality. And I think people have a much more difficult time sort of accepting what the present is than they do. Recognizing the ills of the past and almost, I mean, to your point about going back and providing that historical context, I think the historical context is particularly useful to say, this is where we were. Are we still there today?
That's right.
Of course not.
Well, we're not still there here today, but we're certainly still a racist society. Think about all the minority hiring quotas that you have, the minority businesses set asides that you have to have for all this. I think all that's going to get challenged in court, just like the admissions to higher education got challenged in court. And maybe then you do get to a place where you really are winning contracts, winning jobs based on your merit. And I think that would help tremendously.
Well, yeah, right. No, I mean, that's right. The Harvard admissions case has opened all new avenues of litigation on this matter of the government being in the business of conferring benefits or imposing costs by race, something that, speaking of history, Frederick Douglass, freed slave, argued against because he understood where it went. Unfortunately, not enough Americans do today. But I think the consensus is growing, and it's growing in the direction of Coleman Hughes. Dan and Jeannie Ives in for Amy J., Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Sports and politics and sports and politics and sports and politics and
intersection.
Arrogance and ignorance. Arrogance, ignorance, and arrogance and ignorance.
Intersection.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy is Jeannie Ives, former state legislator, now the host of The Real Story, Sundays 7 to 9 p.m. on these airwaves. This is an interesting sports and politics. Kim Mulkey is a Hall of Fame women's basketball coach. She was at Baylor. Now she's at LSU. She won a championship at Baylor with Brittany Griner. It's odd. And I think LSU plays Iowa, Caitlin Clark's Iowa,
that's
today.
Right. Yeah.
Do they? Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
That's supposed to be like a toss-up. So, I mean, LSU's a good club.
Well, and interesting, Caitlin Clark just surpassed LSU's Angel Reese in terms of NIL deals.
Oh.
So she's number one in basketball, in women's basketball, number four overall for eligible athletes.
Well, I mean, she's certainly getting amazing. The pub. I've seen a lot of Caitlin Clark commercials on during March Madness.
Well, yeah, she's got Nike, Gatorade, State Farm, Bose, Hy-Vee, H&R Block. I mean, Goldman Sachs. Like, those are huge deals.
Good for her.
Mm-hmm.
Kim Mulkey strikes me as, and I don't, you know, really follow women's basketball, but she strikes me as sort of an old school coach, like from a bygone era. We talked about it a little bit earlier when. The Elite Eight games this weekend, and to see Gene Cady, the old Purdue coach, there when Purdue was cutting down the nets, and Zach Edey giving half of his portion of the net to Gene Cady, who's approaching 90, but just it's a bygone era in Big Ten basketball, you know, the era of Gene Cady and Bobby Knight and Judd Heathcote, these volatile coaches that were authority figures, that were tough. They weren't trying to be the players' friends. This wasn't a collegial relationship. It was a hierarchical one. And Kim Mulkey strikes me as that sort of coach, which is maybe why she got targeted by Jeff Bezos' rag, the Amazon Post. And then that got picked up by, you know, one of these nitwit sports writers, LA Times, and you know how the sports press corps works. Basically an adjunct of the D.C. political press corps with a bunch of frustrated athletes and lame journalism students who are just trying desperately to be taken seriously. And they're, you know, most of them are, I mean, there's exceptions, of course, in the annals of sports journalism, the Frank DeFords of the world and stuff. But most of these guys are, you know, nitwits, frankly. And so is the case with many of those attacking Kim Mulkey, it strikes me. So the piece in the Amazon Post, I mean, it just details like her run-ins with players and family members. And she had, I guess, a public spat with Brittany Griner when they were both at Baylor. And then, of course, the insinuation is, oh, well, it was because Brittany Griner's gay. Although that's not exactly what Brittany Griner said. She didn't make a big deal of that aspect of it. But other players and other teams, oh, I wish she would have said something more, speaking out on behalf of Brittany Griner when she was in that Russian prison, you know, despite their public feud and this and that. I mean, it all sounds very pedestrian. A tough coach, and some players didn't like how tough she was, or they had run-ins with her because she's a disciplinarian and so on and so forth. I mean, sort of a nothing burger, it strikes me, but that's not how it's being treated. And in keeping with my impression of Kim Mulkey, here's how she responded to the Amazon Post story she didn't read, but the LA Times column about it, which somebody did send her way, and she had this reaction.
I saw an article. I didn't see it. Someone sent it to me. It was a commentary from the LA Times. I'm not sure if that young man is in here. You can criticize coaches all you want. That's our business. You can come at us and say you're the worst coach in America. I hate you. I hate everything about you. We expect that. It comes with the territory. But the one thing I'm not going to let you do, I'm not going to let you attack young people. And there were some things in this commentary, guys, that you should be offended by as women. It was so sexist, and they don't even know it. It was good versus evil in that game today. Evil? Called us dirty debutantes? Take your phone out right now and Google dirty debutantes and tell me what it says. Dirty debutantes? Are you kidding me? I'm not going to let you talk about 18 to 21-year-old kids in that tone. It was even sexist for this reporter to say UCLA was milk and cookies. Now, you women sit there and you keep your mouth shut if you won't. I'm in the last third of my career, but I'm not going to let sexism continue. And if you don't think that's sexism, then you're in denial. How dare people attack kids like that? You don't have to like the way we play. You don't have to like the way we trash talk. You don't have to like any of that. We're good with that. But I can't sit up here as a mother and a grandmother and a leader of young people and allow somebody to say that.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Yeah, so, I mean, you know, you've got the references that were made to her players. You've got maybe the reputation that LSU has, trash talking and so on and so forth. But, I mean, yeah, why would Kim Mulkey be put in the crosshairs at this moment? The idea of you need good versus evil, that's the, you know, the white hats and the black hats, that sort of typical propagandizing, muckraking by the sports press corps. I mean, I can see that, but I just wonder, Jeannie, the way I'm reading this, I don't know if you're getting the impression. I just wonder if it's more because Kim Mulkey is like a female version of one of those Big Ten coaches from a bygone era I was referencing, and she just doesn't fit anymore, at least according to the sports journalists, quote-unquote journalists out there. She's not woke, and that's why she was targeted.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, she's obviously not going to be pushed around, and good for her for speaking up. I mean, dirty debutantes, I mean, calling, that's, this is the whole thing that you find in politics where they want to just, oh, you know, this is the hashtag Me Too movement again. This is the, you know, you got to treat women as equals and all that. And then on the reverse side, they just want to trash women to their advantage. And I mean, I see the same thing happening here with this LA reporter.
The characterization, I mean, in the in Bezos's rag, the Amazon Post, she had a reputation for holding grudges. She would clash with players, including about their appearances and their displays of their sexuality.
And
where's the, I'm waiting for the delivery.
I'll tell you what, though. One thing, since she is so outspoken, I'd love for her to weigh in on this whole transgenders in women's sports issue. And
yeah,
if she's not willing to do that at this moment in time, then she's basically pulling back on a really important argument where she could be a leader in that argument.
Well, she was asked about, I mean, this is, you know, this is where they're probing her politics. It was interesting how she responded to this question.
It's not politics, it's biology. That's what I hate about
No. I mean, I agree with you on that. But I'm saying, but this weekend, and when she was responding to this press coverage, they were probing, the sports journalists, sports press corps, journalists is you know, obviously a euphemism that they're just hacks. They're political hacks. Mm-hmm. They just happen to cover sports, generally speaking, few exceptions. But they were probing her politics in terms of, you know, so what's going to happen on Easter Sunday?
Oh, yeah, right.
And here's what she said.
Dan Zakrzewski, Outkick.com. Coach, do you have any plans tomorrow, either personally or with the team, to celebrate the Easter holiday?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Every Sunday, if it wasn't Easter, we have devotion. We have devotion as a team. And every morning and every noon and every dinner meal, each kid is asked to pray. And we don't have a room full of Baptists, Methodists. We have Muslims. We have Jewish kids. We have all walks of life. And we respect whatever prayer they want to say. So to answer your question, you better believe that we will do that. Thank you for asking that.
I wonder if that happens at the University of Illinois basketball team. Good for her. This is a public university.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Good for her.
A follow-up. No, I was talking about the Trans Day of Visibility, not Easter Kim Mulkey. That would have been fun if they asked her about that to see what she would have said about that, to your point. George in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, Dan, it sounds like some of those sports journalists were on Don Imus territory there.
Thanks for the call, George. Michael, Southside, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Jeannie. Thank you for taking my call. So it was so nice of the LA Times to edit this article after Kim Mulkey complained about it. So I'm thinking maybe the LA Times should do the same thing for Larry Elder, you know, the same newspaper that called him the blackface of white supremacy. When did that edit happen?
Yeah, great. That's good. Yeah, the blackface of white supremacy. Larry Elder, noted white supremacist. But, I mean, that's how silly they are. And the sports hacks at places like the LA Times are no different than the hacks in the newsroom that would smear Larry Elder in that fashion. That's the point. And you just see it play out over and over again.
And the editors that would print that as well.
Yeah, true.
Do you think the editors even looked into what dirty debutantes is actually? Did they check that out, or did they just I didn't take
Coach Mulkey's advice and Google it, but I have an idea what she was getting at. So you have an idea what she was getting at too, I'm sure. But Michael from Southside is right. So they went back and they took out dirty debutantes because that wasn't in keeping with our standards. I mean, the idea that there are any standards at these old corporate media outlets, Jeff Bezos's little project with the Amazon Post and, the whole gang of 500 and the outlets they represent inside the Beltway, there are no standards. The standard is advance the new Marxist flag, com shop for the new Marxists, for the radical left. That is the charge of the sports press corps, too.
Okay, one other thing here. Where are the other women's basketball coaches coming to her defense, saying something about this? How about the Iowa coach that she's going to meet on the court tonight? What is he going to say in her defense?
Yeah, I mean, she did have – there were some players that rallied to her defense basically saying the same thing that she says. Like, we don't care what people say about us. We're focused on what happens in the locker room. We're focused on winning basketball games and so on and so forth. So
but she's finding a similar cowardice, I think, in sports.
Oh, sure. You know. Well, especially if you're not au courant with the politics. Mm-hmm. So, you know, think about the NBA. I mean, Greg Popovich can pop off about Trump anytime he wants. Steve Kerr, you know, can wade into Trump policies that he knows nothing about and he has no understanding of. That's all fine and that's all well and good. But I mean, somebody wants to talk politics from a different perspective. Somebody wants to say something, I don't know, about endemic violent crime in major cities that disproportionately claims the lives of young black men. Oh, no.
Well, no, then you have to go to your, music moguls and your movie stars for to weigh in on that stuff, right?
Yeah, it's and I it's, you know, the other thing too, I mean, if we're being honest, I mean, Kim Mulkey played this well. I mean, I'm not questioning her authenticity, but the charge of sexism, you know, that's a charge that works. That's a charge that gets the L.A. Times. Oh, yeah, you know, on second thought, that doesn't keep up with these imaginary standards we have. They don't want to deal with a sexism charge. Not from somebody who is not, you know, sort of openly, outwardly conservative. She's not Riley Gaines, for example. Riley Gaines makes a sexism charge. They ignore it. But Kim Mulkey, she got enough player support. She's stayed out of politics for the most part. She's really just sort of communicating her values and her approach as a coach, if anything. And so, yeah, we better watch, not to mention she has black players and so on. So we better be a little careful about that. We don't want black women saying, "How dare you, LA Times?" And so they walk that back.
So do you have a bet on tonight's game?
If I ever bet on a women's sporting contest, that is the
this
day
will
I
will. This would be the one, right?
No, that will be the day I call Gamblers Anonymous and say I have a problem. Dan and Jeannie in for Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.